Hey there, this is Grace Jensen, host of the Newlywed Show podcast. I have been married to my husband Zach since 2016, and we have two little girls. I'm almost finished with my bachelor's degree in family studies, and my dad is a couples therapist, so I picked up a lot growing up that's influenced my marriage for the better. I started the Newlywed Show because I need you to know three things. One, whatever is going on in your marriage, you are not alone. Two, you can learn how to have a great marriage. And three, marriage matters. Your marriage matters. As you level up your marriage, you will learn skills and things about yourself that will translate into you leveling up in every other area of your life. Thanks for being here and enjoy the episode. Hello. We have a repeat guest on the podcast today, although it's been a while since you've been on. Thanks for taking the time this Saturday to record with me, Dad.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here.
So my dad is Dr. Scott Woolley. It's always kind of funny when people growing up would ask what my dad does, because I would say therapist, but also that's like not fully encompassing of what you do, because you have your own practice, but then you're also a distinguished professor at Alliant International University. I know you were program director over the MFT programs there system-wide for a long time. And then you also do a lot of work in training other therapists in emotionally focused therapy. And you have done that all over the world as well as all over the United States, which has been really fun because me and my siblings have gotten to travel with you sometimes.
Which has been wonderful for me when you come.
Yeah, yep. It's been so fun. I have been so grateful for those opportunities to travel. And, you know, I feel like we're getting a little off in the weeds here, but I feel like wanderlust is such like a millennial thing and that sometimes people kind of like roll their eyes about how much money people my age spend traveling. But really, I think even just going on a few international trips in your life can widen your eyes so much to humanity and differences in culture. And I just think goes a way long way in being a better global citizen. And I can't tell you how many times in the last year I have felt that discourse would have been very different had we all had a little bit more of a mindset about global being a good global citizen. But yeah. Anyways,
there we go.
But today I wanted to talk with Dad about negative cycles that couples get into. And this is a topic that I really hope we can cover in a way that is helpful to the listener, because once you get it, I feel like you start to see it everywhere in a lot of relationships, particularly any relationship where there's like conflict or discomfort. I think it actually can be really useful in work settings or in any sort of structure setting where you're trying to get something done, but getting pushback from leadership or things like that. I feel like this can be really helpful. But then, of course, always in marriage, being able to identify how interactions go awry and head those off is huge. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Very helpful.
So we will be talking about negative cycles today from the standpoint of emotionally focused therapy, which is created by Dr. Sue Johnson. So can you just start off a little bit with talking about, and I guess I just did this, but talking about why identifying negative patterns is so important to improving marriages and improving connection.
Great. It's a good question. And really, being able to see patterns helps them be less, the experience of being in the pattern becomes less of a personal experience. So you may be fighting about all sorts of things, but if you can start to see the pattern, it's like, oh, this is bigger than this issue, and it's bigger than just me or how I think my partner feels about me. Mm-hmm. And it's, you can change patterns, and that's super powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like it helps it be you as a couple against the pattern, or even depending on how involved your spouse is, it can be you against the pattern instead of you against your spouse.
Right. Yes. And ideally, it's the two of you against the pattern. But even right. if your partner isn't into that, it can be you fighting the pattern.
Yeah. And we actually spent a decent bit of time right before we started recording talking about that dynamic where one spouse decides to change and what that looks like. We may dive back into that in a little bit. But can you start by, maybe let's start by covering the three main negative cycles talked about in EFT, just to kind of give people an idea of what we're talking about here. And then we can dive into the five layers.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. So these negative cycles Sue calls demon dialogues in her book, Hold Me Tight, or also in her book, Created for Connection, Hold Me Tight for Christian Couples. She talks about kind of three fundamental types of demon dialogues. And the first one that she talks about is really about where couples get into finding the bad guy. And oftentimes, couples really fight and escalate. You know, they will fight. A lot of times, it's like, it's your fault. No, it's your fault. Or, and sometimes it's not that explicit. Usually it's not. It's more, okay, I'm right, you're wrong. Or more importantly, I'm not the bad guy.
Or maybe another way you would hear this is, well, if you had only done this, or if you would have not just done that, is so that another expression?
Lots of blaming, accusations, right. Or it is defensiveness. I did everything I was supposed to do here, okay? Which is, by implication, so you're the one that screwed up, right? So that's one type. And people have, you know, different versions of this that they get into. And a lot of times those couples will fight, sometimes for hours, about, you know, who's right and who's wrong and who's the bad guy and who's innocent. And people will kind of fight for their, a lot of times what they're really doing is they're fighting for their character, for all of those kinds of things, for their personhood. And they're fighting for the relationship. However, that's not what they're saying. They're talking about content. And a lot of times these will go from one content to another area.
Yes.
It'll start off talking about the budget, but then it gets into how people's values around spending. And then it gets into parenting. And then it gets into the dog. And then it gets into the house not being clean. And, you know.
So it can feel kind of like whack-a-mole.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Exactly. So that's the first one, find the bad guy. The second one, she calls the protest polka. And I think not everybody knows what a polka is, but
Sue is very into ballroom dancing.
Right. And it's a type of dance. But in the protest polka, essentially what you end up getting is one person who there's some kind of a conflict and usually something goes wrong, somebody gets hurt, and one person ends up protesting about that by saying, hey, this is not okay. And the other one, instead of fighting back, and finding the bad guy kind of thing, the other one just shuts down and pulls away.
Hmm.
So another one that you've probably talked about, maybe even we've talked about on the show, is we call it pursue withdraw.
Okay.
You know, where you get somebody, and typically the person protesting is the pursuer, and they're saying, hey, this isn't right. Where are you? And withdrawers hearing, conflict, this is going to make things worse, and they shut down and they pull away.
Or is another way that that can manifest that they appease?
Withdrawers often appease.
Okay.
Yes, they often appease. It's like, I am, you know, okay, I'll do it, you know, and I'll mow the lawn this afternoon, I promise. Uh-huh. Okay. And really, they're not really thinking about how they're going to fit that into the afternoon. They just want this, their partner to stop it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and the challenging thing with that, I've seen couples where the protester really is pushing so hard, but you've got to do it. It's really important. I'll do it. But you, it's really, I need a firm commitment out of you. I'll do it. And really what's happening is that because in this case, it was a him and a her, and she was the protester, and he was the shutting down, withdrawer, placator. And for him, it's like, he really wasn't thinking it through at all. And she wouldn't trust that he would do it anyway.
Mm.
In fact, in working with that couple, I remember one of the first things I said is, I want you to get no more commitments out of him. What? I said, you don't believe the commitments anyway. You don't believe it when he says he'll do it.
Yeah.
Well, that's because he won't. I said, okay, so let's stop pushing for commitments.
So that was an example of where she can change her end of the cycle.
Absolutely.
Where she had full control over her part of it.
I said, you're welcome to ask him to do something. That's fine. But don't try to get any promises out of him.
Hmm.
Just ask him and he'll either do it or he won't.
Okay.
And it was actually quite interesting because that changed things pretty fast. Just in, it, you know, there's a lot more deeper work that had to be done. But that little intervention was actually, it was hard for her not to make those things.
Oh, I'm sure.
But one of the things that happened is at first, she only did her part. I mean, she was only doing that. And I couldn't try and get him to be committed because then I'd get in the same relationship with him, right? I didn't want to be doing protest polka with him.
Yeah.
But what happened is after the pressure kind of came off, he actually started stepping up and started doing stuff.
Interesting. So this, looking at this from the framework of reacting versus responding,
mm-hmm.
it looks like, it sounds like her backing off a little bit. Because what, at least in these two things, there's like reaction cycles happening and things are escalating so quickly so that people don't really have a chance to respond. And so in her stopping pushing so hard for commitment, she stopped the reaction cycle. And so he had a little bit more space to try and respond.
Right. Right. And it also calmed her down.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, she would desperately push to get a firm commitment out of which she couldn't believe. And it didn't calm her and soothe her at all.
Yeah.
And when she just decided, okay, I've got to accept that he may or may not do this. And then it really helped us focus on what the real issue was.
Right.
Which had to do with, do I really matter?
Yeah.
Because he's not doing any of these things around the house. Do I really matter?
Yeah. Yeah. And this also reminds me of something that your good friend and my father-in-law, Robin Jensen, likes to talk about a lot, which is expectations. And sometimes in marriage, we have these expectations that we feel are reasonable. But then if you take a step back and ask yourself, well, how is this working for me? How is this expectation working for me? In this example, it wasn't working for her. Trying to get a commitment was not working for her.
Right. Yeah. The solution had become the problem.
Uh-huh.
I mean, she was trying to solve a problem with pushing for a commitment and she couldn't trust it. And just the pushing made it worse.
Right. Right. Okay. So we've got find the bad guy, protest polka. And what's the third one?
Freeze and flee. Okay. Freeze and flee, couples that get into this pattern actually tend to not look very escalated at all because they don't fight.
Uh-huh.
They don't fight. And some people don't fight because they get along very well. Other people don't fight and there's just huge amounts of distance.
Right.
And essentially with freeze and flee, what ends up happening is that both partners are scared that conflict is going to destroy the relationship. So they avoid conflict, but it drains the relationship of connection. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people start going in very different directions. They lead parallel lives, and there isn't the power of emotional intimacy because nobody's risking sharing because everyone's trying to avoid fights.
Right.
So freeze and flee. And it is a demon dialogue in that it is robbing the relationship of the power of emotional intimacy and connection.
Right. And where I see being able to fix this in your marriage translating to the rest of your life is that if you can't be vulnerable in your marriage and receive that support and growth, I feel like that just will always throughout your life happen as you continue to be vulnerable. If you have a hard time doing that at home, it's so much harder to show up in other spaces as being authentic, which then means that it's harder for other people in those outside spaces to be authentic with you if there's just this distance that kind of permeates your life.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely.
So with people in freeze and flee, what often brings them to therapy?
Oh, usually some crisis.
Interesting.
You know, usually there's some kind of a crisis that they can go on for a long, long time.
Right.
And sometimes what ends up happening is that, you know, they drift further and further away. And then somebody just is like, I can't handle it anymore. And someone will say, like, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
And the other partner will go, I thought everything was okay. How can this happen?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so they'll come into counseling.
Okay. So at some point, somebody does...
Somebody
get upset.
Somebody gets upset. But a lot of times it isn't, hey, we got to talk about things.
Mm-hmm.
It's, this is a dead relationship and I'm leaving.
Right.
Because again, I mean, freeze and flee people, there's a lot of fear around conflict. So people, like, they freeze up and they pull away. And it, over time, you know, they may do that in a very big way.
Right. So it sounds like in freeze and flee, even coming to therapy is... a disruption in the pattern.
Oh, yeah. No question about it, because they're starting to talk about it.
Uh-huh.
But working with those couples in therapy is sometimes hard because they tend to sit in front of you and...
Look at you,
and they don't say anything, or they just crack little jokes, and they have a hard time getting talking about the real issues, right?
Uh-huh.
It's like, you know, you guys are here for a reason. Let's talk about this.
Right. Oh, that's interesting.
And they'll be nervous and they'll crack jokes and they'll just be quiet. And it's like, okay, we got to get down to what's going on here.
Okay. Here's like a purely like curiosity question. It has nothing to do with helping anybody's marriages. Would you rather have a couple in front of you like that, who's just like pretty quiet, we'll crack jokes, like it's hard to get to kind of the meat of the issue? Or would you rather have a couple in front of you who, like, you can barely get a word in because they're just fighting?
I don't know. They're both hard.
In different ways.
They're both hard in different ways. I think it probably depends on how much energy I've got that day.
That's fair. That's fair.
But the freeze and flee it's tough. It's just tough in a different way. I'm reasonably good with people who fight, because I'll stop them.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Well, and I think you and I are both a little bit more prone to like fight ourselves. And so I feel like, I don't know.
I get that.
Yeah, you can understand that a little bit more than.
And I can also go in and stop it.
Yeah.
You know, but when it's freeze and flee, it's like, it's harder.
It's a little trickier. Yeah. Interesting. And then, of course, is just your experience, right? I'm sure every therapist feels a little bit differently, but I just was curious about that. Okay, so we have these three basic outlines, but let's talk about the five layers within all of the cycles, within any negative cycle that you're in, and how we can use that to help personalize this a little bit more. Because as you were listening, you might have heard, because honestly, for me, when you were talking about find the bad guy, initially I was thinking, oh, well, that kind of sounds like Zach and I. But then you got to the protest poke and I was like, oh, no, that is what Zach and I have done. But it definitely looked a little bit different than the way that you described it. And then there's no chance in heck that I could ever be in a relationship where Feliz and was a thing, because it's just like not my nature. But so let's talk about the five layers, and maybe as they're as people are hearing about that, they can kind of help personalize and understand a little bit more about their specific negative pattern that they may get in with their spouse.
Yeah. Okay. So, and maybe this is too many layers, but it's helpful for therapists to think about. And I think it's helpful for couples in general to think about. At the most surface layer, we're talking about what people do, and which is kind of what we've been talking about. They mm-hmm. freeze, they flee, they fight, they protest, they shut down, you know. The top level is really behavior. And that's kind of, if you were watching people, that's what you see, is the behavior. But another layer down is what people are thinking. And particularly, it is about thinking about themselves, their partner. We call it view of self, view of other, and also the view of the relationship.
Mm.
So, you know, people are really struggling. Or people, for example, if you grew up with never seeing a parent in a stable, loving relationship, or seeing relationships blow up all the time and all the disruption that comes from that, people that grow up in those situations have lots and lots of fears that this fight could be the end. Mm. Or this fight means that I'm going to lose this person I love so much. So a lot of times, you know, there's this mental model that says, ooh, fighting is dangerous, or I got to fight like the Dickens, or this thing is, I'm going to lose my partner, right? But there is a view of self, view of other, and sometimes view of self is I'm not enough.
Yeah.
Hugely painful. And that can get reinforced by some of the fights. Sometimes it's my partner is crazy. My partner is bad, evil, sick. In fact, it's pretty common a lot of times when couples come in for couples therapy. It's like sometimes they have one of the unspoken agendas is, I want you to see how crazy my partner is.
Mm.
And you fix him. You fix her. Right?
Yes. And actually, I was just emailing with somebody yesterday. He's going to be coming on in a couple weeks. And he was specifically talking about working with newlyweds in something he was working on.
Yeah.
And this was like what he was trying to offer them wasn't working very well because they were just skating past it and felt like, well, if you could just tell my partner why they're wrong, then this could get better. And exactly. So, like, don't think that this is just something for people who've been married a long time, guys.
Right.
Like, I think so often, like, that's kind of I think that can kind of be the first what we see as a solution when things start to go south in our marriage is like, well, they just need to see why they're wrong. And and then how long do you stay stuck in that in your marriage before you're willing to look at some other options, some potential solutions?
And I want to come back to that.
Okay.
If we can put a page marker there.
Yes. Sorry. Okay? I'm going on a bunny trail.
No, that's okay. No, it's actually very relevant to this level of the cycle.
Okay.
But it really has sneak preview. So you'll hang in there for a few more minutes on this podcast. The sneak preview is that most of the time people are not talking about the real issues. And I know you've talked about that at times, but
yeah.
You have to change the level of focus. But anyway, let's mm-hmm. keep going on. So second level then is the level of what do I think about myself, view of self, view of other, view of the marriage or the relationship. The next level down is kind of the hot reactive emotions, frustration, anger, jealousy, resentment, you know, cold, you know, indignity or whatever. Those kinds of things. Emotions do tend to occur at two levels. There's these reactive emotions.
This is important information. Everybody listen up.
Okay. And then underneath those reactive emotions.
Or secondary emotions.
Secondary emotions. What you're kind of think about, they're the hot, hard emotions. think about, but underneath all hot, hard emotions, basically, are softer, more vulnerable primary emotions. And those are emotions such as sadness and fear. And fear is a huge one in marriages and romantic, loving relationships. People are afraid that they're not enough, their partner's not enough, and they are afraid that they're going to lose their partner. They're afraid they're going to be alone. They're afraid that there's just lots and lots of fears, right? So fear is a big one. Loneliness is a big one. Sadness is a big one. And those primary emotions typically don't get expressed unless things are really settled down.
Yeah.
In fights, people express their secondary reactive emotions. They usually don't express their primary emotions. And if they do express their primary emotions, they do it in a secondary reactive way. Like, I'm so scared of you, you're so, you know, right?
Yeah.
Which is really not talking about the fear.
Yeah.
That's really saying angry blaming, right?
Yeah. And I think most of us recognize our secondary emotions first. And also, I think that is largely because that is what society has deemed acceptable.
Right. Right. Oh, yeah. No, exactly. That's exactly right. The primary emotions are more vulnerable to express. I mean, secondary emotions are safer. And frankly, in some context, they can save you. Okay? So if you're up hiking in the mountains and you get attacked by a mountain lion, getting angry and fighting might be very helpful in helping you fight back.
Yeah, more helpful than sitting down and crying.
Yeah, like, oh, I can't believe you want to eat me. This feels so sad. No. Right? That's not helpful.
No.
Okay? And in some contexts, numbing out is a secondary emotion.
Oh, okay. I'm glad you brought that in.
Numbing out is a secondary emotion. And in some contexts, that's very functional. Mm-hmm. If you are a police officer and somebody's shooting at you, or in a war or something like that, you need to shut down your emotions to do your job.
Yeah.
You cannot feel intense fear because it can paralyze you. That usually comes to you feel it later. What you have to do is you have to shut that down and you have to focus on doing your job and keep from getting yourself killed.
Yeah.
Right? That's what you've got to do. First responders in general have to learn how to shut down their emotions. Of course, that creates problems down the road.
Yeah.
Which is why, you know, these days we're doing more critical, you know, incident debriefing and other kinds of things to get people talking about it. But it's often very hard.
Yeah.
For them to do it. You see this with veterans. You see it in, you know, any kind of emergency responder people struggle with that. So there's a functionality with these secondary emotions.
Right, exactly. I was going to say, like, it helps them maintain control of the situation. And so I can see later on when it is time to do more processing and debriefing, there is still that fear of these hard emotions are keeping me in control.
That's right. They're keeping me in control and they're protecting me.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact, and it's painful to go to this primary emotions.
Yeah.
It's not comfortable. It's painful. But in fact, what ends up happening is it's the vulnerable primary emotions that really feed marriages. It feeds romance. It feeds love. It feeds connection.
And I think also feeds humanity.
Yeah, because it helps us be real humans.
Yeah.
That's right. Because we all have fears. We all have sadness. We all have vulnerable feelings.
Yeah.
Everybody out there has vulnerable feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They may act like they don't, but they do. Okay.
Yeah.
And it is one of the things that connects us. And when vulnerable feelings are expressed, typically what happens is it activates empathy in other people.
Yeah.
Okay. If your partner is angry, your response is probably going to be shields up. I got to protect myself. Fear, but fear is going to lead to mobilization to fight or flee,
yeah.
Right? Or freeze. But if your partner is sad, if your partner's hurting, if your partner's opening up in a very vulnerable way, it activates empathy and you want to get closer to your partner. Mm-hmm. In courtship, typically there are times where people risk being open and vulnerable, and that really activates love. If you want to develop love, that's one of the ways you do it, is you get vulnerable and have somebody tune into you. Have them be vulnerable and you tune into them. Yeah. Anyway, so that's primary emotions. And then at the lowest level is, or the deepest level, are attachment needs. Okay? And attachment needs are basically the same for everybody. Mm-hmm. We all need to feel loved. We need to feel connected. We need to feel, I mean, we language them differently, right? Men are more likely to say, I need to feel respected. Okay? Women oftentimes do too now.
Yeah.
But I need to feel respected. I need to feel important. I feel like I need to matter. I need to know that I matter to you. That's very fundamental. Underlying almost all couple conflict is the question of, do I matter? Or how much do I matter to you?
Yeah.
So those deepest needs are met by safe, loving connection. Gosh, when we fall in love and we're tuned into each other and we spend time, we feel like we do matter. We feel loved, accepted, and we're happy. Okay? But then, inevitably, there's misunderstandings. All couples have misunderstandings.
Yep.
And if they don't get repaired, people get into negative cycles. And in negative cycles, what ends up happening is, instead of being vulnerable and safe and connected and all those things that feed love, feed loving connections, people get reactive. They hurt. They get hurt, but they don't talk about the hurts. They get reactive. They get angry. They get into protest polka. They get into these, you know, a variety of other demon dialogues, finding the bad guy, freeze and flee.
Yeah.
And that creates distance. And the deeper needs, first of all, the primary emotions are not expressed. And the deeper needs are not getting met for safety, love, connection.
Yeah. So let's review this. So top of the iceberg is actions.
Yep.
And then next we have thoughts, particularly about self, other, and relationship.
Uh-huh.
And then secondary emotions?
Secondary reactive emotions, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then primary emotions, more vulnerable emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And then attachment needs at the bottom of the iceberg.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Good review. We said we were going to come back to something.
We were. Okay. We were going to come back on the view of self, view of other, what the problem is.
Okay.
That whole piece. A lot of times, and it really has to do with, people get caught up in, I'm the problem, or you're the problem.
Yeah.
Okay. And, or, you know, something's wrong with me. I'm unlovable is one of the most worst ones. Mm-hmm. Or you're defective. And both of those things are, sadly, people think about them all the time, and they're not true. Okay. They're not true. It's not about, I'm not enough. And really, in many ways, people a lot of times think, oh, you know, she, he is so whatever, right? They is so whatever. But in fact, a lot of times we're upset because we love that person.
Yeah.
If we didn't love that person, we wouldn't be upset.
Yeah.
Okay. People react a lot of times because you are important. If you're partner is shutting down. Your partner's shutting down because you're important. And your partner's got fear. If you are getting reactive, if your partner's pushing, getting critical, getting upset, certainly not a functional way of dealing with it, but that's happening because you're important, not because you're not important. Okay, so that's one thing. I think the other thing I was just thinking about is, when people get stuck on content issues, if they're fighting about, and you've, I'm sure, talked about this with other guests, but when they're fighting about whatever it is, kids, sex, money, you know, are the three big ones, right? Mm-hmm. But whatever it is that they're fighting about or in conflict around, it's the toothpaste, whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
The cheese plate. If you listen to my last interview with Chelsea Peterson.
Okay.
We talked about this with the cheese plate.
Cool. Okay. Yes. Really, underneath, they're typically fighting about, do I really matter? Am I important to this person? And, but the problem is they don't talk. People don't stop and look at it. Einstein once said, problems are rarely solved at the level of thinking that created them.
Yep.
I love that because it's like, okay, if we got a problem here, we got to change our level of thinking.
Yeah.
You got to shift, and it cannot be about who's right and who's wrong. It's about, wait a minute here. Okay, that's one level. Who's right and who's wrong about how expensive the cheese was or whatever you're doing, or who's got the best cheese? Okay. I remember a couple I had in Europe once that,
oh gosh,
they had big fights about Italian cheese versus French cheese. And
oh my gosh.
They were Dutch. No, my cheese was better, but it was really about. Hey, do you?
It mattered to them. This was important to them.
And it was really, as we got deeper, is, wait a minute, do I matter? And they both knew it wasn't about the cheese, but it was hard for them to figure out what it really was about.
Yeah, right.
Do you respect me? Do you see me? Do you care about me? Right?
Yeah. And I think also, I think we can have an interaction, realize it went south, and feel kind of shell-shocked. And it can be hard to see and like recognize all of this mm-hmm. for ourselves, let alone try and see it in our partner enough to have a discussion about it. So how do you recommend that couples start to identify the pattern? And then what are some places that they can, I don't know if there's one like best place to try and intercept the cycle, or if there are a few different options you can give.
Well, okay, yes. I just talking with your partner about the cycle is, or whatever the pattern is, let's try and understand our patterns. And sometimes when that happens, people say, well, you do this and you do that and you do the other. And it's like, okay, we're seeing the pattern right here. Uh-huh. But it's like, sometimes people don't want to go there. And if you have a partner who is not ready to go there, you can still do this. You just have to look at your part of the pattern, because you can only change that. You can't change the partners.
I have to add my witness to this, because when I started going to therapy, I guess 2 summers ago now, I initially started going because Zach wouldn't go to therapy. And we had talked about him needing to go to therapy, and he'd said he was going to, and then he wasn't. And so finally I was just like, well, I have to go to therapy because it's being hard for me to be a nice wife because I'm so upset about this. And that was really such a valuable thing for me to recognize. And then I learned even before, and not too long after I started going to therapy, Zach then did as well. But it was so valuable for me to go into therapy and recognize that I was contributing to the problem and things that I could do to change, whether or not he did. And just that, sitting in that space before Zach started going to therapy, before, you know, he really had started to work on some of his things, it brought me so much peace and made me feel so much more aligned and in tune with myself to recognize my side of the street and ways that I could live with more integrity with myself was really what it came down to. And ultimately, that was what started changing our pattern, was me living in line with what the deepest part of me knew to be true and knew about the way to handle our relationship. And then luckily, I think Zach going to therapy really helped him like work on his side of things, which was great. And then we were able to come together. But I cannot stress how meaningful working on your side of the pattern is, even if you only feel like it's 5% of the problem.
Yeah. Well, it's actually amazingly, people are like, get very invested in it's their partner's fault and all that kind of stuff. And again, it's who's at fault isn't the big question. The big question is, how do you change it?
Yeah.
And all you can do is change you. So if you're looking at a pattern, okay, ideally you're going to talk with your spouse about it. You guys are going to kind of sit down and say, okay, what do we do? How do we fight? When do we not fight? How do we fight? How long do we fight? Blah, 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 blah. How does it start? How does it end? Mm-hmm. Okay. The most important place to really learn about is how does it start and how could it be done differently? Sometimes people will bring in, this is pretty common, they'll bring in, you know, something that they've been fighting about, and maybe they had a 2-hour fight and they got to some impasse.
Yeah.
Okay. And then they go and say, well, and they're trying to really show how unreasonable and their partner is, but they come in and say, so what would you do in this situation? It's like,
well, pick a side, therapist.
Yeah, that's right. Pick a side, therapist. And a good therapist will not do that.
Yeah.
And I tend to think, well, actually, I think I'd do everything I could to not let it get this far. Yeah. Let's go back to where it started. And what happens for couples is every time you end up having any kind of demon dialogue, it's actually really important to go back and try to figure out. And ideally, you do this as a couple. But if your partner won't do it, you can't do it. But to go back and figure out, all right, how did this get started? What was really going on? And how could, how could this have gone differently? And most importantly, it's not, well, he could have done this. It is, all right, what could I have done differently in this situation? And again, it's actually quite empowering. Okay? It's quite empowering to be able to say, all right, well, yeah, I did get reactive. And when I felt that reaction, instead of actually doing it, I could have stopped and thought about, all right, something just happens for me. That didn't land well. I wonder if we could talk about that.
Go down the iceberg.
Which is actually changing the level of conversation, right? It's like, okay, I remember one guy saying, I watched him do it in session. It was so beautiful. I've had a number of people do this, but this guy stands out. You know, he was a very strong withdrawer. They had a protest polka kind of thing, right? And he was a very strong withdrawer. He just would drop just like that. But as he's coming out, he's recognized the pattern, he's seeing it. He got to the point where he'd say, you know what? I'm feeling blamed right now. And this is a time when I really would shut down. And I don't want to shut down because I know it's going to hurt you. But somehow when you say X about me, I'm feeling like you're saying I'm a bad guy. And his wife stops and goes, oh, I had no idea. Okay. That's quite helpful for me. And then some people will say at that point, well, but you shouldn't feel that way, which is not helpful because they do feel that way.
Yeah.
Okay.
That is.
You know, so-and-so, most people wouldn't feel that way. If I just said this, most people are just fine. My friends, I can say this to my girlfriends and it's all fine. And it's like, yeah, but you're not married to your girlfriends.
Okay? Yeah.
You're married to this one. And it's more about not whether it's reasonable that you say this or not. It's, does it bring the intended effect? In other words, all right, if you say this, are you really trying to have your partner feel blamed and criticized? Or are you really asking for things to be different? Okay. And that's actually, as long as we're talking about how to stop these demon dialogues and get out of them, another huge, huge, huge thing is lots and lots of couples get focused on what is being done wrong that isn't working, rather than talking about, thinking about, and asking for things to be done differently.
Yeah.
So I wonder, would it help you if I did this differently? And it also can be, it would help me a lot if you would do this differently.
Yeah.
Okay. There's a big difference if I say, you do this, and it makes me feel so mad or hurt or whatever, you're all of a sudden feeling blamed.
Yeah.
Right? Instead of, I think it would be so much easier if you said it this way. And, you know, you're just inviting. Mm-hmm. You know, this didn't land well. This is painful. I'm sure this is not what you meant. But, gosh, it would be really helpful if you said it this way.
Right. And that would help me feel A, B, and C, more positive emotions, which sounds more inviting.
It sounds more inviting. You're asking, rather than telling people what they're doing wrong, you're asking them to do it differently.
Yeah.
You're focusing on solutions rather than problems. And that may sound simple, but it's actually so incredibly profound. Mm-hmm. Okay? It's incredibly profound. It is important to understand where the problem is or what's going on. But most importantly, you don't always have to understand the problem. You just have to find the solutions.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Which I know that may not sound like it makes a lot of sense. You don't have to find the problem. You just have to find the solutions. But I think that if you just start trying to work on that and do it, you may end up accidentally finding the problem as you're trying to find the solutions.
Yep. Yep.
Like, you'll get there.
Yep.
You'll figure it out. I also want to acknowledge, though, how scary it can feel to, instead of telling your partner what they're doing wrong, ask them to do something different. Because then the fear is, well, what if they don't do it? Which, to go down the iceberg, is, what if I don't matter enough to them to do this differently?
Yep.
But this is where owning your side of the street is really important, because then you're making an assumption about your partner. And you can ask them and either get that assumption confirmed or denied. Mm-hmm. And if it's, well, yes, my spouse isn't willing to change, then you have more information about their vulnerabilities and fears, and that they are not currently willing to work with you, or you have more hope and information that they are willing to work with you. And that is really encouraging towards spurring more change and more vulnerability.
Yeah, no, that's true. And if they're not willing to change, a lot of times it's because there's some block within them.
Yeah.
And it very well may be, they think if they change, that means that somehow they're the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a huge, so many people grow up in families where to be wrong means you're bad.
Yeah.
Which is like so limiting. I mean, it's actually a very, very pretty destructive thing, and they can never admit that they're wrong.
Right. And I feel like we have seen this so much in the wider culture in the last year, year and a half. And we don't have to get into specifics, but there, I think, have been so many missed opportunities to listen to people in pain that have been missed, because you call it American culture, call it whatever you want, but like, there's this really deep fear of being wrong.
Of being wrong.
And if I'm wrong, that means I'm the bad guy, which means I'm no good.
Right. And that it means I'm no good. When in fact, strong people can admit that they're wrong. And they change. And they become even stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Really amazing people. If you think about people you know in your life that you really admire, people that, not politicians, not people that are out there, not movie stars, but people that you know. If you've known somebody who is just a truly amazing good person, I think if you think about it, you'll find that they're very open to the fact that they get things wrong. Mm-hmm. And they make changes and they move on. You know, yeah. It's such an empowering thing. It's actually very disempowering to not be able to be wrong.
And there's always the opportunity to come back and apologize. If you notice this in yourself, which I definitely do at times where I come back and I don't think I'm wrong, da, 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 da. I retreat, check my facts, whatever, and I realize I'm wrong. You just come back and apologize. Mm-hmm. And it sucks, but then you know what it does? It encourages me to not be so reactive next time. Mm-hmm. And be less quick to assume that I'm 100% right the next time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, there's, in terms of being able to stop these patterns, seeing them helps. Seeing the leading edge. Seeing how they get started. And you go to what's going on underneath, and then what can I do differently in the pattern? And what are my real needs? And, you know, how do I ask for them in a way that they can be heard by my partner instead of my partner thinking I'm saying that she, he, they are the bad guy?
Right. Do you ever have people write this down?
Yeah, sometimes.
You know, I'm just thinking that especially if you want to talk about this with your partner or maybe just want to do some introspection first, I can see sitting down and writing on a piece of paper, you know, actions, thoughts, secondary emotions, primary emotions, and attachment needs being, or, you know, however those things make sense to you,
yeah,
being really helpful to start being able to unpack this in yourself and then something to go back and reference in when you do get into an argument.
Yep. And speaking of that, it's really important to understand that your behaviors have a huge impact on the deeper, vulnerable emotions and attachment needs of your partner.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of the way these demon dialogues operate is somebody does a reactive behavior, they're critical, they shut down, they do whatever, right? They blame. And that leaves the other person feeling insecure, unloved, scared. And then they get reactive emotions and they then engage in behavior that ends up leaving you feeling unloved. And so understanding, one of the sad things is that in when there's conflict, when there's fights, when there's serious problems in a marriage, for example, both partners typically feel very powerless.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is that they actually have a lot of power. It's just not in the way that they want to.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, they part of it is they don't understand how they're feeding the other person's negative behaviors. Well, and because they don't see it and they don't want it. And they're I've been doing marriage counseling for over 30 years. Most of the time, both partners have really been trying.
Yeah.
But most of the time, neither one thinks the other one is, sadly.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Oh my gosh. I see this so clearly in my own marriage. But really what you're talking about, particularly with actions driving the other spouse's feelings, it reminds me a lot of the criticism defensiveness spiral sucks episode that Zach and I did a few weeks ago, which, not to toot my own horn, but I think that might be one of the best episodes that Zach and I have done together, where we talk about this in our relationship and how it was so important to me for when I hurt Zach's feelings, rather than him trying to stuff it down and then bringing it up to me in an abstract way a week and a half later, I needed him to give me the specific example of what I did to hurt his feelings, mm-hmm, so that I could understand what it looked like from my side of the street. Because I didn't know. He would start talking about some principle and I would say, yeah, that's important that we not hurt each other's feelings that way, but I don't understand how I did that to you. And so that's why it's so good to be able to understand this on like a macro level of your pattern and what happens in your thoughts and feelings, so that you can bring it into specific situations and make sense out of it and understand yourself and your partner better.
Yep. Yep. And it sounds like I haven't listened to that one yet.
That's fine. You don't have to.
But it sounds like what you're talking about is you, because the patterns just kind of go. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you guys stopped and really tried to take it apart and understand it.
Yeah.
And then you learned how you could do it differently.
Right. Can we, thank you. I'm very proud of that. But I can think of another very specific instance where I recognized a pattern was happening and it didn't go very smoothly. So maybe you can speak to this, and there are kind of various ways that trying to address a pattern in the middle of a situation can look, and that's okay. Last summer, I remember this really vividly. Zach and I were having a conversation. I don't remember about what exactly, but I recognized all of a sudden that we were in the pattern and he was doing the same thing that we had identified happens before. I remember getting super upset, bursting into tears, halfway yelling at him, to be honest, "You're doing this thing. Please don't do this thing." And like running out of the room we were in and like running into the garage and like just like crying, like putting my face in my hands and crying for a while. And, cried it out and then came back in. And then we were able to talk about it. And he was sorry, of course. He hadn't been intending to be doing that thing that is hurtful. And so it wasn't necessarily very smooth. Just because you, when you do feel calm, you can identify this, doesn't mean that in the moment it may not feel very calm or in control. But because I was able to identify it, and even though I was very emotional, bursting into tears, I remember saying, "Please don't do this thing." Like I feel like I said it in as nice of a way as I could. And then I exited until I could calm down a little bit. And then we were able to come back. And I think he was probably also able to have some time, think about what had happened, recognize his way of contributing to it. And then we were able to work through it. And even though it was emotional, it was still so, it was dealt with so much more effectively and quickly, and had was healed. We were able to recover, whereas something like that before would have just been so painful for days. Like it just would have added on to kind of a pile of hurt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's great. That's wonderful. That, you know, because you guys did talk about it, you looked at it, and instead of it getting acted on and creating a pile of hurt, mm-hmm. or getting added onto a pile of hurt, as you say, you guys were able to identify it and heal it.
Yeah. So can you speak to a little bit more? You kind of recognize your pattern, you talk about it, and then you realize in the moment when emotions are high that it's happening.
Yes.
What is the best way to proceed?
Okay. Well, it depends on the pattern. Okay. That's a little tricky question.
That's true.
It depends on the pattern. I'm going to back up a minute.
Okay.
And say, when you, okay, you've talked about it, you know that, for example, when you react a certain way, that your partner is going to get hurt, frustrated, whatever. One of the things that's actually very helpful to do in that situation is imagine doing it differently. Getting a mental representation of what it would look like and checking it out with your partner. So if I were to say this, would that land better?
Mm-hmm.
Would that feel better? Because I want to do this differently next time. And then when you're in that next time, you've got hopefully this, okay, wait a minute here, someplace I need to do this different. I know I need to do this different. What is it? Okay, boom, and then you can do it. Now, that takes a while, okay? That takes a while to learn. Sometimes you can get it on the first try.
Uh-huh.
Particularly newlyweds, it's a little easier sometimes than if you've been doing it for 40 years.
Yeah.
Okay, but it's actually a really valuable thing to imagine it first. Give yourself a mental representation of it and talk with your partner. Is this going to be helpful or not? And then give it a try and see what happens. But you do have to feel it. You have to recognize it.
Right.
And if you don't, and you do it, you know, the old way, and you get the old reaction, even in that moment saying, oof, I blew it, I didn't, we talked about me doing this, and I didn't, I'm sorry, how you doing, can we have a redo? Sometimes people are into redos, sometimes they're not, that's yeah. okay, depends on how reactive things are.
Yeah.
Stopping it, though, is super important.
And saying, we're in that cycle, we're doing that protest polka thing.
Yeah, that's right. And, yeah, we're doing that protest polka thing. And sometimes your partner, if your partner is not into it, might say, well, you may be doing it, but I'm not. which is, I've had couples come in and say, she was in the cycle this week, but I wasn't. You know, I'm like, well, actually, by definition, you're both in it. But let's not get into a fight about that. Okay, because that's really who's the bad guy.
Uh-huh.
Instead, I will say, okay, I think we're here again. I want to do this differently, and I don't think I am doing it differently. If you focus on what you are doing differently, then you can stay out of your partner feeling blamed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the end of the day, okay, if you end up doing 90% of the work, and your partner does 10% of the work, and things get better, and you have a happy marriage and a happy life. Eh. Okay. Chances are, though, that you'll think your partner's doing 10% of the work, and your partner may think that they are doing 90% of the work, not 10% of the work. I mean, the whole, that thing, you know, I'm a big into, you can only change yourself.
Yeah.
And you do your best. And that doesn't mean you can't ask for change. You can and you need to. Because your partner isn't a mind reader.
Yeah.
Okay. But in the end, you can only change yourself.
Right. But you can ask for change in a way that can set them up to be the hero.
That's right.
So to speak. And I think this is something also that my father-in-law talks about. Is like, I just want to feel like Jan's hero. And so, and I think that's a common thing with guys, you know, feeling respected, feeling like the knight on the white horse, whatever, of presenting it. Like, if you could do this for me, it could make me feel this way. And then it's like, oh, well, yeah, I want to be the husband who makes his wife feel this way.
Mm-hmm.
Can we back up, though, and talk a little bit about freeze and flee? Because I feel like that's a little bit different than protest polka and find the bad guy. What's a good place to go for couples who are in freeze and flee when they recognize that they're in it? Because they may say, we're in freeze and flee. I'm feeling blank. Like, if they're just not used to having those conversations at all, like, how do they start to have them?
That's a good thing. And a lot of times, couples that are in freeze and flee, it's dangerous for them. That's why, you know, and their instincts are to pull away. There's a couple of things, though, that can be helpful. One is having some structure.
Hmm.
Okay. So for couples like that, sometimes setting up some structure of, we're going to have a time to talk about our relationship, whether we like to or not. Doing a workbook together on your relationship.
Okay.
Okay. There's a good, Lori Scatty recently wrote a book. I can't remember the name of it, but maybe we can get it in the show notes or something.
Yeah, I'll put it in the show notes.
It's a workbook for couples in emotionally focused therapy. It's got some great little exercises in it, and it's good. There's a couple of different ones out there.
Yeah.
But hers is very simple, and it's good. Having some structures like, okay, we do this. Also, you know, therapy can be helpful. I mean, therapy can be helpful. Not everybody's going to come to therapy. Sometimes freeze and flee people also can do, they may not come to therapy, but maybe they'll do a kind of a seminar or something, a marriage seminar. There's a lot of hold me tight seminars out there.
Uh-huh.
Or creative for connection seminars.
Right.
And you can do them anyway. And you're involved in Becca's one.
Yeah, we've talked about it a little bit.
Yeah. But anyway, there's it's doing things like that.
Right. Chelsea Peterson has kind of a group one, like that's
Rebecca
like a weekly
Jorgensen
one.
Jorgensen has an outstanding one.
Yeah.
That
it's way cool.
You can put in the show notes. Maybe. Uh-huh. But that is quite powerful, I think. And it's very related to Homey Tight, I think. But
yeah.
It is, there's just various variations out there. Sometimes doing that can be helpful because it's structured.
Right.
And structure oftentimes can bring safety for people who are into freeze and flee.
Right. I also think Jeremy Bowden has a course for newlyweds specifically. Mm-hmm. And you, or even people who aren't even married yet, that I think going through that, I think it's only $99. It's like an incredible deal. And, you know, I think that for newlyweds can be so helpful in starting to like recognize some of these things, getting some language.
Oh, yeah. And there's a lot of things. The Relate Institute has also got a thing you can do online.
Yeah.
$10 or $20 or something like that.
Maybe what I'm hearing, though, for freeze and flee couples is start something.
Just do something. And you can do, and yeah, do something and set it up so there's some structure to it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I'd also say for freeze and flee couples, it's one of the big dangers there is people, I mean, people can do this in any type, but freeze and flee couples are so oftentimes into avoiding conflict that they give up their selves. They give up their dreams, their hopes, their, you know, because it's all about avoiding the conflict, right?
Yeah.
And it's really, if you're going to have a good marriage, you have to hold on to yourself. You have to have a self to give to your partner. And you don't lose yourself by giving. You lose yourself by faking it.
Yeah.
Okay? You lose yourself in unhealthy ways by acting as if you are not who you really are. Okay? Which is not helpful. If you're going to have a really healthy bonded, you've got to be honest about where you are. You've got to own the way you feel. It doesn't mean that you are going to impose that on people. It doesn't mean that your behavior is okay. But it does mean that your desires, your interests, the things you're excited about, you don't have to give those things up. You do have to figure out how to moderate when, where, and how.
Yeah.
But you got to keep hold on to yourself in order to have people sometimes will give up themselves in order to have a good marriage and it never works.
No.
Okay. You got to hold on to yourself to have a good marriage.
And I wonder if this is more common in religious couples because we have this weird thing sometimes that happens in a religion where to be Christ-like is to be peaceful or to feel the Holy Spirit is to like feel no conflict ever, which isn't scripturally based, actually, if you look at the Bible or in other things. I just think sometimes we think that the way to be a good Christian is to be like calm and submissive all the time.
Well, I mean, Jesus does talk about being meek, and that doesn't mean that we are not, I mean, meek people own themselves.
Mm-hmm.
There is a place where sometimes meekness is very powerful. There's a great power to being meek. It's being confident and assured,
right,
with who you are. And at times it means taking a very firm stand.
Mm-hmm.
And for Christian couples, looking at what Jesus did, Jesus took some very strong stands.
Yeah.
Okay. It's interesting because there's a wide variety of behaviors. The more secure we are, the more healthy we are, the more secure we are, we can match our behaviors with the context. And I'm going to illustrate this with Jesus and apply it back to us.
Okay.
If that's okay. I don't know if that's okay on this podcast.
Oh, of course. Of course. Let's do this.
Okay. So at times, Jesus very much engaged the crowds in loving, kind teaching. Sometimes he was pretty strong with the Pharisees and Sadducees of his day that were leading the people away.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, so he engaged pretty strongly at times. Sometimes he was submissive when it was the right time. Sometimes he withdrew. Okay? not just the 40-day fast one before he started his ministry, but at times he got on a ship and got away from the shore to get away from the crowds.
Mm-hmm.
He went up into the mountains to get away from the crowds. Okay? Sometimes it was too much. But he did a wide variety of things. Healthy people have a variety of different coping mechanisms. I mean, again, if somebody's shooting at you, it's fine to numb out and do your job. Keep yourself alive.
Yeah.
Okay? And you do that too much and you bring that home to your marriage and it's going to be very destructive, right? In some situations, the house is on fire. You probably do want to be yelling and trying to get everybody out.
Uh-huh.
Okay? You don't want to sit around and freeze and not doing anything. Okay? The house is on fire. You want to get people out. That's what you need to do. In other words, you need to be activated. Somebody is shooting at you. You don't want to be screaming and yelling because then you become a target.
Mm-hmm.
You want to shut it down. Okay, those are true extremes. Healthy people are able to match their behaviors with the context, not just do one thing all the time.
Okay,
so freeze and flee, oftentimes it's shutting down all the time. You way overuse that. Okay. People who are in to find the bad guy or even the protest part of protest and polka, is the protesting a lot of times it is, I'm going to put it out there all the time. And it's like, no, that isn't always what is called for by the context.
Yeah.
Right? I think Jesus, I mean, he carefully braided a whip, which does indicate it wasn't necessarily reactive. It's one way of thinking about it. But he did drive the money changers out of the temple. He took a strong stand. Okay? He was also allowed himself to be taken to the cross. He actually healed the ear, you know, and when this, you know, that Peter chopped off the ear of one of the soldiers and he put it back on.
Yeah.
It's like, no, this is right now, this is not the time to be using a sword.
Yeah.
Okay. This is not that time. At other times, I mean, gosh, they tried to throw him off a cliff, you know, when he announced his messiahship. He slipped through the crowd, got away. So he withdrew.
Yeah.
Okay. He withdrew in that situation. He did not withdraw at the end. There's, you know, healthy people, it's not like we're just one way if we want to be Christian or if we want to, and this, lots of different religions in addition to Christianity.
Yeah.
What we do is we have behaviors that match this situation. Same in our marriages.
Right. So just recognize if maybe you have some religious stuff rolled up in this that you kind of have to work through in terms of, okay, what is a good wife? What is a good husband? What does a good relationship look like? And ultimately, God created you. God created you to be who you are and to improve who you are. And I believe with the deepest part of myself that marriage is a place to work on yourself. And it is probably the best tool outside of having a relationship with heaven directly to help us improve our individual selves in that relational context. So be willing to do the work, be willing to try and see your spouse and see all the layers of the iceberg with your spouse. And know that if you can name it, you can tame it.
Yeah.
As you taught me.
Yep. Absolutely. You can name it. You can tame it, particularly with emotions. Mm-hmm. You can name them. You can tame them.
Yeah. And with the patterns that feed those emotions.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming on today, Dad.
Oh, it's been delightful.
It's been really fun.
Thank you.
I always love talking to you.
Yep. Me too. I love talking to you. And I'm so happy.
Thanks. And thank you, listener, for being here today. Hopefully you learned a lot, maybe took some notes. If you enjoy this podcast, if you could please rate and subscribe on Apple, that would mean the world to me. Thank you so much. Bye.